Can the capitalist media prevent socialist change? This is the first in an occasional series of socialist answers to the big questions. James Ivins, Socialist Party National Committee. Have you ever found yourself shouting at the TV because the talking heads just keep missing the point? They let the establishment off the hook, they ignore ordinary people or blame them for society's problems. Have you found yourself thinking, if only other people thought like me? You're not alone in feeling alone. 4/5 of Britain's online news market is controlled by 5 big firms, the Media Reform Coalition calculates. The same proportion of the print news market is controlled by just 3. And they do not share your priorities. Net profits in the media average 23%, according to a 2011 Ernst & Young study. This is around twice the average return on capital, more in line with banking than normal sectors. Whopping profit for interactive media, including social platforms, it's a whopping 35%. Why? These super profits are a result of the special power wielded by some sections of capitalists due to their role in wider society. Financiers have become the real rulers of the world under capitalism. Banks can decide the fate of whole industries by, say, opening or closing lines of credit. They use their power to dominate the other capitalists and command a bigger share of the loot. Media barons have a certain power in the world of ideas. By controlling what and how information is reported, they can attempt to influence public moods and developments in markets and politics. Obviously, they try to do this in a way that protects extraction of profits. There is also state media in most capitalist countries. This is not neutral, however, any more than the police or the courts. It defends the interests of the system as a whole. The BBC has been a far more reliable liar for the government than even the Tory press during the pandemic. Social media, meanwhile, offers bosses marketing opportunities of an unprecedented scale and effectiveness, huge reach. This is a key reason for its exceptional profitability. Some liberal commentators have even blamed social media for the rise of right-wing populism and reactionary leaders like Donald Trump. They blame bubbles and echo chambers, in effect, seeing ordinary users as empty vessels who accept anything poured into them. So how does this explain the rise of reactionary movements before the internet? And what about the hours and hours each day which people spend in real life with work colleagues, family members and friends? The truth is that falling living standards, alienation from traditional political parties and impasse at the top of society force people to seek alternative ideas. Any given form of media is just one road network people travel in that surge, not the engine that propels them. The Sun, owned by billionaire Rupert Murdoch, infamously declared it's the Sun what won it, after the 1992 Tory election victory. Following Jeremy Corbyn's defeat in December 2019, many blamed the establishment media's campaign of lies. This is an important factor, but the media's control of events is overstated. People's experience of reality limits what ideas take root. In fact, the media is only one source of ideas, real events themselves provoke them. Corbyn's anti-austerity leadership made Labour two parties in one. While his pro-worker policies were very popular, Labour administrations in local government carried on with brutal cuts and sell-offs. Corbyn accepted a confused position on the working class vote, to leave the capitalist EU. And he seemed incapable of standing up to the Blairites in his own party. Could he really resist the banks and billionaires, if he took power? Working class people heard positive promises from Corbyn, but felt real attacks continuing in his name. This turned the soil for the capitalist media, including liberal outlets like The Guardian, to sow their lies. Smear the Smear campaign decried Corbyn's lack of charisma, while depicting him as anti-Semitic, a Stalinist and even a terrorist. Some working class voters repeated these talking points. Pollsters and journalists on safari in working class communities found false confirmation of their own prejudices, that workers are gullible and reactionary. They caught the sense, but missed the meaning. There was class fury at falling living standards, and being taken for granted. There was suspicion of a party seen to be complicit in it. There was frustration that nothing ever seems to change. had they really talked to working class people about these things, as the Socialist Party does, they might have learned all this. People felt angry, alienated and disoriented, and needed a way to explain and express it. The hypocritical slurs of the capitalist media were the most widely available tools. But, you might ask, won't that always be the case in a capitalist society? And doesn't that make it impossible for socialists to break through? Under mass pressure, it is possible to win reforms that improve press freedom. But in a society ruled by billionaires and the market, with huge costs for operating mass media, freedom primarily means freedom of the rich to print what they want. In September 1917, just weeks before the working class took power in Russia, Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin estimated that the three main nominally socialist parties command from three-quarters to four-fifths of the votes. However, the circulation of the newspapers they publish is certainly less than a quarter, or even less than one-fifth, that of the whole capitalist press. This shows the limits of capitalist media influence. It's also a warning that the capitalists can regain control of ideas unless there is revolutionary change. The working class needs to take the means of producing and distributing news and political and economic power as a whole out of the hands of the capitalists so they can be democratically organized. In capitalist society, workers' media can supply explanations and demands that truly correspond to working class anger and needs. But most important is that it not just propagate alternative ideas to the many who are receptive. It must act as an organizer to turn them into facts on the ground, to convince the broadest sections of the working population. From 1983 to 1987, militant, forerunner of the Socialist Party, led Liverpool's Labour Council in a struggle against Margaret Thatcher. Not just the Tories and their press, but also the Labour leadership and newspapers which supported it, slandered militant again and again. The Catholic Church even threatened to excommunicate congregants who voted Labour. Yet Labour's vote, membership and active participation continued to rise. How? The city was building thousands of council homes, and creating thousands of jobs, bricks and mortar proof of whose side it was on. What's more, it was doing so under the ongoing democratic control of Liverpool's working class. Trade unions, campaign organizations and local labor branches elected delegates to the District Labor Party, which debated and decided all the council's policies. The council mobilized mass demonstrations, and de facto city-wide general strikes, and won millions of pounds from Thatcher. When the boss's press told workers that the council was their enemy, they could say, "What do you mean? We control the council." Workers could feel their collective power and thrash out independent class ideas, breaking free of the isolation which leaves individuals unarmed or demoralized before the capitalist media lies. The most important next step towards such a movement today is a new mass party of the working class, a kind of workers' parliament, to facilitate collective political engagement. The only newspaper consistently explaining and organizing for this is the Socialist, the weekly paper of the Socialist Party,